Hello, and welcome to Juniper's Cabinet of Curiosities. I'm Juniper Rain, and I have a story I want to tell you. A story about a police officer and the day he realized he might not be cut out for the job. So grab a blanket and let me take you on a drive down memory lane. Ever since I can remember, I've wanted to join the police force. More so, I wanted to be a detective. But, as anyone knows, you have to work your way up to the top. The day I turned 17, I walked myself down to the police department and asked for an application. 17 was the minimum age to join in my small town, and I could complete the rest of high school at the same time. My parents approved, of course, because they saw it as a way to keep their teenager away from trouble. I submitted my application, and by the next week, I was enrolled in the police academy. I packed my bags and hugged my mother goodbye to set foot and live at the academy for the next 4 months. To no surprise, I thrived in the academy. It was easy for me to adjust to the schedule, and the physical demands were not too taxing on me as I'd always been fit. The sit-down and learn classes were a bit harder, followed by long nights of studying to retain the thousands of laws we had to learn so fast. During the first of many classes, the instructor said something that always stuck with me. There will be a call in your career that haunts you to the core. You'll want to vomit and lose all composure, but you'll have to keep it, and you'll have to come right back here and do it again tomorrow. The words echoed in my ear every time I went on a call for the first year or so. Finally, after the normal year of average calls, I began to forget about the words and stop wondering when my haunting would happen. 2 more years passed of me being on the force, and everything was going great. I was promoted to a driver, and even did some patrols and calls without anyone else. Then, I got assigned to my partner. We call him Harry. Harry and I were a dynamic duo. We prevented crime and put away the bad guys, just like I'd always dreamed. On our off time, we would sit in the office and chat. He would tell me about his wife and kids, whereas I was living the more bachelor lifestyle. I had no wishes to settle down. One day, as we were sitting in the open floor office, our crime check gal came over to us. "Hey fellas, would you mind performing a welfare check for me? It's a little odd." She trailed off. I began to think of why she would ask us this. We didn't normally perform those, as they were reserved for more, rookie cops. "A little odd, huh?" I asked. "These 2 ladies called and said there's a shipping trailer that's been parked on the side of the road they take to work. It's been there for a week now. We need y'all to take the cutters and go see what's inside. See if you can find the owner before you cut, but it looks abandoned." She spoke clearly. "Always up for a challenge," I said as I put on my jacket. We walked out the back doors to the patrol car and drove a whopping 4 miles to the destination. As soon as I saw the semi, a cold chill ran down my spine. It was all white. The trailer stretched long over several rows of large, flat tires. I guessed it to be about an 18-wheeler with an extension. Printed along the side of the truck in big blue letters was Beverly Freight in caps and nothing more. No number that we could call, nothing. Hands on our service weapons, we exited the patrol car and took a look around. No one was inside the front cab and the doors were locked. We walked along the side nearest to the road, then to the back. The latch was locked with a thick metal padlock. Looking down, we noticed that there was no license plate. We walked along the other side of the truck when we noticed all the outer tires on the side were flat. Upon looking closer, we saw that they had been slashed.
"Officer Payton to dispatch," I said to my radio.
"Go ahead,"
a female returned.
"Yeah, we're at the side of that welfare check-in. Something's not right here. The truck's got no license plate, and the tires on the other side are slashed."
"One moment."
The pause that felt like eternity filled the stale, cold air.
"Officer Payton?"
she asked.
"Here."
"We're gonna have to ask you to get back in your squad car and wait for backup to arrive."
She said that with a sense of urgency that made my skin crawl.
"Copy."
In the safety of our car, we talked about all the possibilities of what could be in the back. Drugs, a bomb, all the other stolen vehicles we'd never found. All of the above. The firemen were the first to arrive. They also stayed in their trucks. Two more squad cars, one of which I recognized as the captain's, and finally, the bomb squad. The trifecta of emergency services. One that hadn't been called in the entirety of my time here on the squad. After bomb squad dogs smelled and didn't alert, we were cleared to exit our vehicles. The firemen grabbed their massive jaws of life to cut and pry the lock off the hinges. After just a few seconds, a large metallic snap rang through the air, and the lock dropped to the floor.
"Payton, Rogers, grab my six. Fire and bomb, be ready to make the final clear once we're done," Captain shouted. "We want to make sure we secure all the areas. Check this whole trailer, bottom up."
The air went strangely still for a few minutes as Captain counted down. 3, 2, 1. After the countdown, another all-too-familiar chill ran down my spine. In one swift motion, Captain unhinged and pushed the big metal door up to the top. The sound of metal clinking as the door hit the roof of the trailer was the first thing I noticed. The next was the distinct stench of death that came wafting from the door instantly. I would recognize that smell anywhere after I did a welfare check on an elderly lady. I'd found that she had been dead in her recliner for a number of days.
Guns drawn, we followed Captain, entering the trailer that somehow looked even bigger from the inside. Along the back row, there were stacks of about 10 mattresses. All of the mattresses were stacked on one another. They were all filthy, covered in human waste and blood and who knows what else. In front of that, there were several cars, some that looked like they had been set ablaze and exploded. All of the rest of the floor was lined with more mattresses, some looking as if they had been used recently. Blankets thrown and lying on them. There were a few crates filled with MREs, something the military gave to soldiers in combat. Alongside those were wrappers and bits of scraps. Something or someone had been living in here.
"This is the police department. If you're in here, please come out with your hands up," Captain shouted. His deep, gruff voice echoed through the walls of the semi.
"We don't want to hurt anyone. Come out now," he added.
After a few moments of silence, Captain instructed us to disperse around the edges of the vehicle so dogs could come in and sniff for bombs again. Once they had done so, we began our search of the area. One officer broke the window and searched the cab of the truck. It was a lot of trash and used drug material. I made my way to the cars, as that was the first thing that caught my attention the most. There were 3 cars in total. The first 2 had been burnt to a crisp, nothing more than the skeleton intact, pushed over to one side of the area. Then, there was the 3rd car.
this one was not exploded. It was in normal enough condition, banged up and dirty. The trunk was open, which immediately caught my attention. I walked slowly over to the final car. My heart was beating out of my chest as I feared what could possibly be inside. I reached with one shaky hand, something I had never experienced in the force, and opened the trunk. What I saw made me jump and was nothing like I had expected. Inside the trunk, curled up naked in the fetal position, was a girl, or rather a woman, holding nothing more than a teddy bear. Her long brown hair was matted and coated with blood. Some patches had begun to fall out at the scalp, but were still matted and hanging on to the ends. By the shape of her and the fact that she hadn't moved, I thought she was dead, wide-eyed and staring into nothing. But then, she blinked. "There's a woman! We have a person over here!" I shouted, voice cracking from the adrenaline. Captain came stomping and gasped as he saw the scene. "Someone get the E-blanket and prep the ambulance! We gotta get her to the hospital!" he bellowed with urgency. If I'm honest, what came next is a blur. Detectives came in and surveyed the place. They uncovered several hundred pounds of various drugs, as well as counterfeit money. Blue lights indicated that nearly every surface was covered in various bodily fluids. None of the cars were stolen, and the majority of the drugs were backyard made and cut with cheap materials. Nonetheless, this was a reasonable bust. The worst part, though, is the bodies. They uncovered a total of 5 female bodies, all of which were naked and looked as though, for a point, they had been living there while sustaining massive amounts of abuse. Most had succumbed to their injuries, one due to starvation. The surviving woman we found turned out to be a missing 21-year-old sex worker. She hadn't been seen for 6 months. She was transported to the hospital and lived to tell the harrowing tale. After months of intensive care, Abigail finally spoke. One day, she was working the streets as she always did, when a client solicited her services. She got in his car, and he drove her to the semi-truck where he said he'd been living. He got her in the back, where she saw that there were 5 more women, all living there. He had sex with her, but he did not pay. When he was done, he locked her in there with the other women and left. The other women we found that were all alive at the time when Abigail got there filled her in on the situation. Each had been lured and kept against their will. Day after day, the man that took them would bring in various men through the cab entrance, and they would sexually assault them. When the women would fight back, they would be violently abused. She disclosed that the first woman to be killed was strangled right in front of her when she began to refuse. Every time someone had come in over the last few days, Abigail would climb into the trunk that I found her in and pretend to be dead, trying to escape the abuse for a few moments longer. Abigail was eventually able to give us a description of the man who took her. She said that he went by the name of John, not surprising as most of the men who had solicited the woman did. He spoke in an aggressive southern accent. We were able to build a very specific profile for the man and put it out there to the public. To be honest, it wasn't long until someone called in about weird Uncle Johnny, who always gave them the eyes during family brunch. Sure enough, we went to his house and brought him in for questioning. He didn't say much, but he did agree to stand for a lineup.
I went to the hospital and picked up Abigail in my squad car myself. I'd been the one who found her and had been there for every interview she had since. It only felt right for me to support her through possibly seeing the man who abused her for months.
Abigail stood on the other side of the glass, trembling in her hoodie and sweatpants. I'm here for you, Abigail. If he is in there, he can't hurt you. We're gonna get the man who did this to you. She looked at me for a moment. The men, I mean. I corrected myself, remembering the intensity of the trauma she had endured. She nodded. She fiddled with her hands in her hoodie pockets as an officer brought in a line of 6 ginger-headed men with beards. She looked down, tears streaming down her face. Take as long as you need now, Abigail, I assured her. She looked up after a few moments with glossy eyes, then dried her face on her hoodie.
Is there any way that we could just have them put on a hat? He wore a hat a lot, and I just want to be sure.
No problem, said Detective Benson, who was beside me. He motioned over to the door guard, who grabbed 6 black hats and passed them to each man. Hats on, please, Detective Benson spoke, pressing the blue intercom button. As soon as the men placed the caps on their heads, Abigail began to sob. She looked down for a minute and turned away.
It's number 5. I recognize him better with the hat.
She paused.
It's the way his hair curls over the edges. I'm sure of it,
she cried. That's enough, I said. Benson waved the men away and took lucky number 5 back to the interrogation room. Creepy Uncle Johnny. I got Abigail a hot tea and led her to another room to calm down. You did a lovely job, Abigail, I assured her. You were so strong. Anderson, in here, Benson shouted from the end of the hallway. I'll be back. You just rest here. You're safe. I jogged over to the hallway where Benson was. Yeah, boss. You found the girl, and we owe this to you. It's only right you come in alongside me and hear what he has to say. Detective Benson nodded. Thank you, Detective. I tried to hold in my excitement as I selfishly thought of the opportunity of being a detective after this. Detective Benson led me in, and we took a seat opposite to Johnny. Let's start with who you are, huh?
John Wilkins. I'm 45, and I lived here for years.
And why'd you move here? Benson asked.
My dad died, and I got his house. The one you snatched me from.
Yeah, kind of like how you snatched up those girls. John looked down for a moment, then back up. Look, Mr. Wilkins, we want to help you, but we can't unless you tell us what happened. Benson raised his eyebrows.
Look, this is a mistake, he finally answered.
Is that so?
Listen, I never meant to kill those girls. I didn't realize how bad the other guys were treating them. When the last one died, I slashed the tires and I never went back. It's more than just me, man.
He squealed. Here's what we're gonna do, Benson said. Benson went on to offer Johnny a deal. He had to make a full written statement of everything that happened, and all the other men involved. If he did so, he'd be offered aid in his time in prison. Benson was straight with him. No matter how he pleaded, he was probably going to jail for life. John sat down for 3 hours and wrote the detailing of a year of abuse on 6 women. John's dad was a trucker, who also left him the truck. John began hiring sex workers and then using his truck as a place to take them. He paid them at first, Then he discovered that he could just take them, and he thought no one would find them. He offered them a lot of money, drugged them, and then left them in there. Up until the truck was called in, he kept it on his property so no one would see it. He would invite various men over and even sometimes drive the truck girls to the men's houses for parties. John wrote a list of at least a dozen men who had solicited these services. He wrote large X's next to the ones that he found were responsible for the girls dying. But newsflash for creepy Uncle Johnny. If you kidnap a girl and she dies, it's your fault regardless. Abigail's medical testing came back and was positive for John's DNA. The fingerprints were found at the scene for 5 other guys. Unfortunately, some of the men gave fake names and we never found them. John was convicted of 6 counts of murder and over 100 counts of other violent charges. Life in prison. The other guys got varying sentences from 5 years to life, depending on their involvement. As for me, I ended up retiring from the police force. I just couldn't get those images and those smells out of my head. That was the day that I learned that the worst monsters are human. Regardless, I have to thank John. After all, if it wasn't for him, I would have never met my wife.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode, Beverly Freight. I hope you enjoyed it. If you enjoyed the story, you can subscribe to Patreon for bonus episodes, exclusive content, and more. The first bonus episode will be out on October 31st, Halloween. Today's episode was written and produced by Juniper Rain Gallegos, and music is by Fesslian Studios. See you next time, and stay safe and spooky.